For $800,000, Karen Eldridge and her family have essentially bought a town and a slice of Alaska's past. Eldridge admits when she first saw the asking price for the Paxson Lodge, she faltered. But the figure encompasses lodge, gas station, post office, and other structures. And Eldridge says she and her husband and daughters felt they were up for the challenge.
We ran the Texaco in Delta Junction for 24 years. We built it. And we had a catering business, the girls and I. We had the station leased out, and we went into the catering business and had it for 3 years until we had to take the station back, and it got too much at two different places.
So the family closed up and sold the Delta shops and bought their way into history. After Felix Pedro discovered gold in the Fairbanks area around 1903, a flood of would-be miners made their way north. Many traveled a narrow road stretching between Valdez to Fairbanks that eventually became the Richardson Highway. Springing up to serve the gold seekers was a series of roadhouses. History professor Terrence Gold says the Alaska Roadhouse was more, though, than just a way station.
The roadhouse throughout Alaska was a social center for all the people of the surrounding area. And because in those days travel was overland and they didn't have the motor vehicles, obviously, that they have in more modern times, roadhouses were evenly spaced 20 to 30 miles apart, or about one day's travel. And so, in a way, the entire landscape of Alaska was dotted with roadhouses, and Paxson Lodge, or the roadhouse back in those days, would have been one of them.
Well, many of those lodges have disappeared. Paxson Roadhouse has survived. It dates from 1907, when many traveled by horse, sled, or bicycle. Current owner Stanley Brown says the main lodge was built in the early 50s. And for the past 37 years, Brown and his wife have catered to a brand of tourists who now, more often than not, arrive by RV or float plane. But Brown says time has changed more than transportation for him and his wife.
Well, we're easing ourselves up. My wife and I are getting up in years. I'm 77. I thought it was time to go fishing.
Still, Brown says he and his wife plan to stay in the area after the fishing season. And for their part, the new owners, the Eldridges, hope to pass their piece of Alaska history on to their children and grandchildren. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
Twelve villages around Galena are working to bring the internet closer to home. With help from a $715,000 federal grant, teachers and administrators are forming the Yukon Regional Education Consortium to build an interior telecommunications network. Galena School Superintendent Carl Knutson says the villages will receive computers, training, and software enough not only to link them together, but to link them with the world.
We are going to set up what is called an intranet, and the intranet would link the 12 villages together on their own network. And the students then would be putting their work and their email communications between the villages on a system that would not necessitate them going out on the internet, but that the faculty, the teachers could also, and the community organizations could also communicate with each other without going out on the internet.
Aside from the telephone, students in Hoosliab have been relatively isolated from the net. Teacher Fred Kerrigan says the network will supplement the information they receive from the usual broadcast and print media.
What this multimedia internet access is going to do for us is bring alive a lot of the newer technologies, the new ideas. It's just going to hook us up to the current events and current thinking in the world.
Villages will access the system with a toll-free 800 number, and organizers plan to develop websites to host the best student work. In addition to hardware, the grant will support a computer technician who will travel to each village to offer training and troubleshooting. Knutson says once the net is running, they'll offer access to other community organizations at reasonable fees. In Galena, I'm Scott Campbell.
Three, two, one. Last session, Governor Knowles bestowed a Medal of Bravery on Delta Trooper Rose Edgren. Knowles was acknowledging Edgren for her bravery in a Delta altercation where she wounded Johnny Carter after he fired on her. Carter claimed his gun went off by accident, but he was eventually convicted of attempted murder. Now, some in Delta complain Edgren was too quick on the draw. Recently, some 60 residents signed a petition saying the trooper is also mean-spirited. Jean Ottenstroyer is one of those who signed the petition.
She's gun-happy. I mean, she's scared of guns. Like the person that she shot down here, I forget what his name is. He's in jail in Fairbanks right now. He was putting his gun down and she shot him. That's by witnesses, and then that's by his brother, and if the person's putting his gun down, why are we shooting the person?
Ottenstroyer, who believes women shouldn't hold law enforcement jobs, says if Edgren doesn't like a person, she'll go out of her way to harass them. But he adds that's rumor. He hasn't experienced it firsthand. Captain John Myers from the Fairbanks Trooper's Office says when he received the petition, he was puzzled because it didn't give details. But he says it was serious enough for him to set up a meeting this Thursday with petitioners.
Right now, all I can tell you for sure is that I got a petition that's vague, except they requested us to transfer a trooper, and we're going to go ask the people why.
Myers and Colonel Glenn Godfrey from Anchorage will meet with Delta residents at the community center this Thursday at 5:30 p.m. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon. Three, two, one. You have to put your faith in the community, Lane Thompson says. Thompson heads up the Fairbanks Borough Library Commission, and he and fellow members struggled through 11 meetings to fashion the new display case policy.
Ultimately, I think that we, as a community, depend on trust for one another. That it isn't laws that make us a community, it's trust. And we simply cannot make enough laws to take care of all the possible bad things that could happen.
Instead, says Thompson, he and other commissioners compromised between constitutional law and common sense to craft a new set of guidelines for local organizations to follow when using the library display case. Last year, a Gay History Month display in the foyer sparked a rancorous debate. After the commission upheld the display, the debate spilled over into the borough assembly, where some members tried to legislate more restrictive measures. Eventually, the issue was sent back to the Library Commission, which recently came up with the new guidelines. Borough Assemblyman Hank Hove runs radio and television stations, so he says he's especially sensitive to free speech issues, and he's pleased with the new policy.
I think they steered a fairly centrist course through this minefield, and I think that it's an eminently workable solution. I don't expect the issue really will be coming up again anytime soon before the assembly, and for that, I certainly wish to extend my gratitude to the commission.
Among other changes, the new guidelines streamline the appeals process. They require disclaimers be posted along with displays. There's a sunset clause, so the commission must reconsider the guidelines' effectiveness every 2 years, and the policy also heightens the public profile of future exhibits, so patrons have a warning on any upcoming controversial topics. But Mike Prox isn't so sure how effective this last requirement will prove. While Prox wants to avoid a repeat of last year's acrid confrontation, he doesn't think the guidelines go far enough to protect the public from controversy.
Well, I would recommend that they consider some wording in their policy that if a display has potential to generate controversy, that they ask the people that might be offended by the display to come together and review it, if you will, and comment on the display before it opens.
Crox now hopes quiet dialogue might replace public rancor. He says after the dust had settled from last year's public flare-up, he had a meaningful discussion with Mary Bishop. Bishop is the president of Parents and Friends of Lesbian and Gays, or PFLAG, the group that mounted the gay history display. For her part, Bishop says PFLAG also wants to avoid another bitter debate. That's why the group is withdrawing its request for another display.
I don't think that it would do our mission and our goals any good to just immediately come back and use the same divisive technique, which we didn't think was divisive because we'd done it already and had been ignored. But there are other ways we can get our message across.
That message, says Bishop, is simply that gay and lesbian kids need and deserve their parents' love and support, and that homosexuals contribute meaningfully to society. But even though PFLAG is avoiding the public library's display case, doesn't mean controversy will. Topics for future displays include the National Wildlife Refuge and the right to life. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon. Northland Wood only runs its mill during the summer months. Still, it manages to produce up to 2 million board feet of timber a year. And says operations manager Alan Menneker, the company's been doing a brisk business, supplying the needs of local home builders. But Northland is now looking to step up its business and maybe double production. To do that, says Menneker, they'll need to sell where they've never been able to sell before.
A lot of business on the bases. A lot of commercial work we have not even been considered because the architects and contractors know that they're not getting certified lumber.
It's not that Northland's wood isn't up to scratch, says Menneker. It's that company graders who evaluate the quality of the lumber haven't been certified. This summer, Northland dug into its pockets to the tune of $4,000 to change that. They brought up an independent evaluator from Oregon who trained and certified 7 Northland employees to judge wood by industry standards. Trouble is, says Menneker, so far the rating hasn't brought in any new business.
We've tried this year. It has been relatively costly. But we haven't been able to get around to contacting the new base of customers that we're looking for. We got certified right at the height of our busy season, and we've just been staying busy, so we haven't been out fishing for the new market.
One of the companies Northland Wood will probably angle for is Alcan Builders, one of Fairbanks' more successful general contractors. Fred Johnson is part owner, and he welcomes the timber company's new standing, not just for what it does for the construction business, but also for what it does for the community.
We'd be very pleased to do business locally versus having stuff shipped up from the outside. Availability would be better for us, and if they could hire more help, that means they're going to have to have more housing, they're going to spend money at Safeway or Super Value or Foodland or whatever, and go to the movies and one thing after another.
One way Northland hopes to attract builders like Alcan is to competitively price its lumber. But given the price of certification and doing business in the North, owners say they're giving this experiment 2 years to prove itself. Then they'll reassess their strategy. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
When the Delta Greeley Community Coalition formed to brainstorm ways to save the local economy, the result was a long list of business ventures. In May, the coalition hired the 7 firms led by Agra Environmental of Fairbanks to weed out the impossible ideas. Project manager Doug Butine says the consulting group's first version of that list puts primary emphasis on farming.
At least at this point, we are focusing on the seed potato industry as one possibility. We're looking at the raising of beef, possibly the raising of buffalo, and that sort of thing, as well as an increased grain and non-meat agriculture.
Coalition Director Ray Woodruff says the community is most interested in agricultural development, and the consulting group has identified 5 specific strategies.
Our first strategy would be to expand the dairy production and processing. The second strategy would be to expand the production of hogs and cattle. And the third strategy is pursue potato and vegetable processing. And that's here for the local area, of course. And the fourth strategy would be to develop ranching and processing, buffalo ranching and processing. And then the last, of course, is conventional and advanced indoor agriculture. And this is a new one that we're looking at in a little more detail.
Tourism ventures and other uses for the base facilities, such as elder hostels or a school, will also be on that list. Woodruff says the next phase of the economic development contract calls for actual business plans.
And then once those plans are completed, and we're hoping they'll be done in August of next year, that we'll be able to go to various agencies and obtain some financing and help other people, businessmen, get financing to do some of these jobs.
Woodruff says the coalition is still looking for grant funding. They've requested almost $500,000 from the Defense Department to finish up the economic development plan and fuel the coalition until the year 2001, when the base will be cut back to half staff. In Fairbanks, I'm Teresa Bacher.
Alyeska has spent hundreds of millions of dollars in its repairs. Is that sufficient, and did it do the job? There's a tremendous body of information that says, that supports the claims of the workers that the spending is not sufficient and is not doing the job. My concern is that failure to do it correctly places us at increasing risk of a major oil spill or a fire or explosion that could cause loss of life as well as environmental damage.
Jennifer Rise, Alyeska Media Relations Manager, or Alyeska Spokesperson.
Okay. What? I guess, first of all, what's your initial reaction to what Feinberg's saying?
Well, we appreciate that they're interested in the pipeline and the job we're doing, so we certainly welcome their comments and their input. In 1993, the BLM conducted an audit in which it assessed what we were doing as a pipeline and where we were going, and they made some recommendations. Our owners also did a complete assessment of the pipeline system and had some recommendations as well, and since 1993, we've been implementing those recommendations. We feel we're on the right path and that we're going down the right track, if you will, and so we take their input and welcome their input. At the same time, understanding that we don't think it's useful to go back and start at square one again.
One of Feinberg's, what kind of his main thesis is that that cost-cutting at Alyeska has kind of dovetailed and worked against a 20-year-old pipeline to make major problems and essentially raise the risk of a major spill.
We don't believe that cost-cutting has had that effect, and in fact, we haven't reduced costs as dramatically as perhaps Mr. Feinberg might think. The ramp-down plan has been initiated, and you know, with reduction in facilities and lower throughput, there is a need for fewer people and for you know, less equipment, less maintenance on equipment, that kind of thing.
Picture a scene from rural America. Father and son are out in the misty marshes, shotguns in hand. They've had a successful day of hunting and are returning home with a half dozen mallards. But statistically, they've killed 8 because 2 have gotten away, and if they're not dead yet, they will be soon enough. Shotgun advocate Tom Roster says that's a statistic that's going to kill the sport.
In the U.S. alone, you're looking at somewhere around 2.5 million
ducks and geese that annually are struck but not retrieved by waterfowl hunters. Now, that's not a number that anyone can say is an insignificant number.
Roster's been traveling the nation as a hired gun for ammunition companies, sportsmen, and fish and game agencies. He's preaching politics, urging activism, and teaching shotgun techniques aimed at making hunters more skillful.
Pull! Got dust out of the front. Good. Pull! There, you shot right above it. Fire and keep on swinging. Pull! Perfect.
Roster and others have put together these workshops for several reasons. Some years ago, biologists discovered many ducks that consumed lead shot were dying from lead poisoning. In 1991, agencies mandated hunters use non-toxic shot, but shooters protested, saying the lighter steel shot was increasing wounding losses because it performs differently. Roster began working with ammunition companies to improve steel shot, and in his research, discovered most wounding losses aren't caused by steel, but instead by unskilled hunters. The workshop teaches the rudiments of shotgun ballistics, estimating range and hitting targets. After 6 hours of instruction, in which he shot at least 100 shells, lineman Dave Kieser says he's a better hunter.
I think it'll make a big difference in our hunt. Instead of going for the center of the flock, be going for the ones on the outside. Knowing distances, that's a big thing. Not taking a shot that's too far away, which I've been guilty of. And I've seen a lot of people guilty of that.
Before he came to the workshop, Kieser was already a good shot, and he says knowing he can hit with steel makes him more confident. But not everyone's convinced. Steel shot can damage the barrels of some older guns, and the flying shot forms a tighter pattern. Down Under Guns ammunition salesman Ed Schultz says even among skilled shooters, the jury's still out.
I would agree that you do need to be more selective. You do need to take closer shots, and you do need to take because of the patterns, but it is not all of that. Part of it is the performance of the steel, and that is real steel is a lot lighter than lead. It is not as hard on impact as lead is. Basically, it just hits something and punches around holes through them.
Schultz and others argue that like lead bullets, lead shot causes more damage and therefore kills more quickly. There is a second non-toxic shot on the market. It's made from bismuth, which is heavier than steel, so it performs better. It's also new this year and difficult to get, but Mike Phillips at Mountain View Sports in Anchorage says it's a big seller.
We've stocked quite a bit of bismuth this year. We started early in the year stocking the bismuth, and we're just about sold out of it. We found that it's been real popular with the waterfowlers. They like the performance. It's real close to that of lead, although it is approximately twice the cost of steel.
The shells cost almost $2 a piece, but for hardcore hunters who've already bought a boat, decoys, and other gear, Phillips says they'll pay extra for performance. Some gun dealers say bismuth will replace steel, especially if demand helps push down prices. But Roster says bismuth is rare, and the price isn't likely to fall. He expects steel will stay, and so do the ammunition companies that have invested heavily in promoting steel's adoption. But some 30% of hunters still refuse to use steel shot, and whatever the load, Roster says that attitude will contribute to the end of the sport. Since 1970, the number of waterfowl hunters has dropped by nearly half to about 1.4 million. They're mostly white men with an average age of 41. Father and son are now more likely dad and grandpa. These factors, Roster says, are all combining to reduce the political and economic power of waterfowlers.
That's a serious issue, that if that continues, this waterfowl hunting, no matter what kind of shot you shoot or whether you like it or not, there's just not going to be enough waterfowl hunters to maintain the sport.
Roster advocates setting aside hunting areas for kids only. He wants to recruit women and minorities into the sport. He says America is today where Europe was a century ago, a nation of urban people who don't hunt and don't understand why someone would choose to kill and eat wild animals.
The way hunting was saved in Europe was the hunters realized we've got to gain the respect of these non-hunting people that think what we're doing is unneeded and maybe even gross. And so they recognized that the only way you're going to get respect is you've got to show people that not just anybody can be a hunter. You've got to demonstrate some knowledge to become a hunter. you've got to demonstrate skill.
In Germany, that means knowing ecology, biology, and ballistics, as well as proving shooting skill. But this is Alaska, a state that doesn't even require a hunter education class. Roster says there's no choice.
Places that have saved hunting are the places that have developed responsible, knowledgeable, courteous, competent hunters. And that, to me, is the challenge for the future. So if somebody says, I'm too important, I don't need to go through this, then I say, do we really want these people? They're a threat to the future of hunting.
But if it's up to hunters to save their sport, they have a big job ahead. Opponents are well organized, and Roster gives hunters 5 years to reverse current trends, saying if they don't, in 20 years, there won't be any hunting for current shooters, much less their children. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.
All you did is you let the gun slow down. You got to fire and keep swinging.
This has not been an easy summer for me. It began when my wife, Julie, got a job scheduled to last 6 weeks. Unfortunately, her hours were like balloon payments on credit cards. What started as a few hours a day mushroomed into a full-time plus commitment. No problem, I said. I'll take vacation and care for our 2 kids those weeks. Now, being a child of the 60s, I envisioned something along the lines of the Andy Griffith Show. Even though my daughter is only 19 months and my son is 5, I expected we'd exchange whimsical banter as we sauntered down to the Chena to skip stones and wave at the riverboat Discovery as we passed. Call me a cockeyed optimist. Since my workday usually begins before the family rises, how was I to know the breakfast table, in fact, every room of the house, is basically a theater of war for my kids? While I trudged back and forth to the washer and dryer with a seemingly unending string of laundry baskets, Rommel and Montgomery exchanged tank fire in the living room. While I vacuumed, my daughter was gamely hanging on in her room while the Battle of Britain raged. Every evening at bath time, U-boats exacted a ruinous toll in the tub. By the end of Julie's job, I was suffering from post-traumatic stress syndrome and in need of R&R. But the worst was ahead. I'd forgotten we'd invited Julie's sister and her 2 young children to stay for part of the summer. Understand, I am an only child. Julie, on the other hand, comes from a large family. She has something like 6 to 12 siblings, so many I have trouble keeping track. To her and her sister, 4 kids was low population density. For me, it became Bosnia. Even though each weekday I escaped the strife early, I eventually had to return. And there I'd find hostages still being taken with abandon, ear-splitting cries of outrage and pain tearing through the house, and treaties being negotiated and broken like clockwork. My calls to the UN went unanswered. My sister-in-law and her kids finally left just as the birch trees were yellowing. And that's when I realized what generals have always known. It's nearly impossible to mount a successful winter campaign, even for my in-laws. So I figure I have at least a 6-month respite of numbing cold and darkness to look forward to, and in which I can plan my defenses for next spring. Hoping you're continuing the good fight, I'm Robert Hannon.
Karina Olin and Brian Duncan set out on foot Tuesday morning with a gun and some food. They expected to be back home later that day after spending a few hours looking for a moose. But Olin says they got lost.
We just were looking for a moose and we just went a little too far and we got lost. And we went through a bunch of grass lakes at night when it was really dark. So it was just like a maze. And I don't know, somehow we just got further and further.
Olin says about 17 search and rescue crews from Galena and nearby villages were out looking for them. The couple saw some planes overhead while they were trying to get home. Howard Beasley and Mark Huntington found them Thursday morning using a jet ski, which is a water-going version of a snow machine. Olin says the couple thought they were on Bear Creek, a major slough of the Yukon River, but were actually 5 miles north of Galena, lost in a series of grass lakes.
I was scared. I was the one that was scared, but Brian, he just kept my hopes up and saying, we're going to go home. But I don't know, we just kept on going too far away from home.
But they did make it home, and with time to spare before their son's first birthday next week. The couple were dressed warmly and slept by a fire each night. They ate high bush cranberries for water. Olin says although they didn't get a moose, her boyfriend's planning another trip, but this time he's going alone. Olin says she's not walking for a while. In Fairbanks, I'm Teresa Bacher.
Though it's not the biggest spectator sport, the McGraw School has a local tradition to carry on when it comes to cross-country running. This year's team has been doing more than their share, Dusty Parker reports. Okay. 3, 2, 1.
Running is the fastest natural way of human transportation. As a sport, it equalizes people. You don't have to be from a big community or financially stable to run. You just run. And that's what a small group of young adults from the McGraw School have been doing to the best of he or she's ability this fall. The team bases their ability along with personal and team goals. Cross-country coach Bob McGuire.
The teams are just formulating their goals. I think that last year the boys' goal was to encourage all the runners to do their best and to be one of the top two teams at regional. This year, the boys would really like to be the number one team in our region.
Last year at the Region 2 meet at Sioux Valley High School near Talkeetna, Arctic Knight runners Joey Wittenkeller and Aaron Marks crossed the finish line together to come in first in the 5K event, bringing the team to a second-place finish. With almost the same philosophy as last year, junior runner Aaron Marks has slightly changed his plans for this year.
My goal for state is to come in the top 10, and I got top 30 last year.
If it's not the athletic body, it's the healthy habits. The team's number one goal this year is to beat Sioux Valley High School on the 30th of September. Reporting in McGrath, I'm Dusty Parker.
3, 2, 1. While they've been gone, nature has been moving from summer to fall. Hunting seasons have started, and fire crews felt the pressure to come home and continue getting ready for winter. Bob Rabarchik of Galena directed 5 crews from Chivac and Hooper Bay. He says these crews had already caught and prepared most of their salmon for the winter. Still, they voted to come home instead of extending their stay and earning more money.
They had concern about getting back primarily for the bird hunting, geese and ducks, and then also for other game like moose and the seal. The area that they were from, that's primarily what they subsist on, are the sea animals, the seals and the whales and fish. But I guess there are more moose in the area now. And then they also hunt a few caribou, too. And, yeah, it seemed like the majority of the members on the crew, they really wanted to stay but felt they needed to get back.
Karen Evans of Galena usually goes out with the Galena crew. This time there was no crew boss available, so she filled the position on the crew from Shungnak. Evans says she would have loved to extend her stay, but some people were missing their homes and families.
This crew that I went out with to Shungnak, a lot of them were real disappointed because they wanted to get home for caribou hunting up there, too.
For a 21-day contract, a single firefighter can make almost $4,500. When a full crew of 20 returns to a village, it can mean more than $85,000 coming in. Some villages like New Lotto and Caltag had 2 crews out, so the economic benefit doubles. In Galena, I'm Scott Campbell.
Each year, the state surveys miners and other companies to develop a picture of the industry, breaking spending into 3 areas, exploration, development, and production. Last year, development spending grew by more than $100 million to push the total mine value to almost $720 million. 3 mines accounted for 86% of development spending last year. They include the Fort Knox near Fairbanks, the Nixon Fork near McGrath, and the Red Dog Mine near Kotzebue. While mine expansion added workers, jobs in the placer industry fell. After 12 years of operation, the Valdez Creek Mine along the Denali Highway closed down. Overall, 37 placer mines called it quits, dropping placer employment about 15% to just under 1,000 jobs. Report author Tom Bunsen at the Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys says there are several factors squeezing small gold miners.
The prices remained about the same for a number of years. The costs have increased so that they have to go to higher grade deposits to stay in business. They have run out of reserves in key areas, like in the Circle area, for example. They just don't have as many operators up there as they used to have. And finally, there's some operators just are frustrated by lots of regulation.
Bunsen expects placer employment to level off this year. In terms of production spending, gross value was up 6% in 1995 to $537 million. Most of that was driven by a 15% increase in lead zinc production at Red Dog and record production from the Usabelli coal mine at Healy. Exploration spending also rose about 10% to $34 million. Among commodities, Bunsen says prices for scrap metals also rose, spurring a 50% jump in exports.
Many steel mills now in the United States are fed by scrap rather than primary iron ore, and they're running short of scrap, and so the prices are way up. And we're seeing a lot of compacted cars here, even in Fairbanks. Several thousand of them were compacted in 1995 and shipped south on barges to Tacoma for processing into primary steel and iron products.
Government action also contributed to expansion. The state approved a mining incentive that provides credits for exploration expenses, and the Mental Health Lands Trust mess cleared up. Bunsen expects 1996 to be an equally strong year. The Greens Creek Silver Mine in Southeast restarted production, and several other projects will be in full swing.
We will see the completion of the development of Fort Knox, and it is expected to go in production late this year. The Red Dog Mine has reported an operational profit for the first time, I believe, and they are expected to produce even more zinc concentrate than they did last year. So, and increased amounts of exploration all over the state for mainly gold and base metals.
Miners once complained that Alaska was a lousy place to do business. That seems to have changed. While costs remain high, stable government policy and a push among native corporations has kept the industry growing. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.
It was a little frightening. it's hard for me to imagine myself not seeing the board and remembering where all of 32 pieces are at. And that was what he had to do. And then he had to remember which pieces were taken off the board and not only where they were at, but where they could move to.
We had food, but the only thing is we didn't really have that much to drink, so we didn't have anything to drink yesterday or today. We were just practically surviving on high-bush cranberries.
Meaningful elections depend on informed citizens. We're asking listeners to participate in KUAC's Front Porch. If you have a question for the candidates or just a general comment about the election, please call us at 474-7491. We'll record your question, perhaps put it to the politicians, and play their responses on the air. So get involved, because good government depends on active citizens.
People are asking for wolf control because moose population is at the lowest it's ever been, and people are having a hard time, since they live on subsistence, feeding their families, and they realize that wolf is helping to keep moose
moose population is low.
I understand there was a meeting on Monday. What prompted that and what happened?
The meeting on Monday was kind of a pre-meeting to come to a community consensus on how and what to present to the assistant to the governor, Tim Tworek, who was here Tuesday afternoon for a meeting. It was a definite consensus that yes, wolf control is wanted in the area, and they would prefer a land and shoot method of wolf control.
Tell me what happened at that meeting. I understand a lot of people came out.
There was a lot of people that participated in the meeting. Many people are concerned about this. It affects their lives. There was a local fish and game biologist who presented studies that he's done in the area that back up the cause and effect of moose population being low and wolf predation high.
How did we get to this situation?
Well, four of the last 7 years have shown us severe winters where snowfall has been extremely high, and this has caused low moose population, but it's the high wolf population that keeps it low and keeps the moose numbers down. They aren't able to come back up.
I understand Tim Tworek from the governor's office was out there on Tuesday. What did he hear, and what's he plan to do about that?
Well, Tim Tworek will take the concerns that were expressed at the meeting Tuesday afternoon back to the governor and fill the governor in on what's going on out here. The governor himself will make a trip to McGrath on the 27th of September to hear firsthand from the people in the district about wolf control.
I'm curious what kind of reception he's going to get.
He's going to hear what people have to say. They're not going to sit back and let wolf control not happen. They really believe in it, and they're going to let him know that.
This first flurry of suits is aimed at World Plus insiders or those who receive preferential or large payments, says attorney Cabot Christensen. Christensen was hired by the court-appointed trustee to sift through the 1,000 or so claimants against Jeannie Bonham and her self-styled flight coupon business. He's also charged with getting back some of the estimated $50 million in missing assets. Christensen says it's clear Bonham was running a Ponzi pyramid scheme where new investors are needed to pay off old players. He says that gives him a legal green light to try to recover investor money from day one.
There is a rule, you might say, in bankruptcy that you can go back 90 days to recover what they call preferences. It's 90 days for most creditors and 1 year for insiders. There is more or less a little body of law that is specific to Ponzi schemes that permits the trustee to go back further than the 90 days, either under state law or federal law.
Christensen emphasizes he's not involved in criminal investigations against Bonham by federal agencies. Christensen filed the complaints Monday in Anchorage Bankruptcy Court and sent copies to the investors by regular mail. One Fairbanks man was facing nearly $250,000 suit. Many others looked at actions in the tens of thousands of dollars. By Wednesday, though, many named in suits hadn't received notice and declined to comment. A list of World Plus investors reads as a who's who of Fairbanks society, including prosecutors, lawyers, teachers, and professors. Christensen says more suits are pending.
As you can imagine, there's a certain logistical effort involved with filing and serving 47 lawsuits. We will be filing other lawsuits in the future. I do not know yet how many it will be. I don't really have an estimate. We're analyzing the files and compiling the information and filing them, and my office is working very hard.
Christensen does say, though, the next volley of suits will be filed in Anchorage Bankruptcy Court next Monday. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
Imagine hiking for hours and finding yourself surrounded by nature, reveling in the peace and quiet that can only be found by getting away from the sounds of civilization and the road system. When suddenly, helicopter intrudes, carrying tourists on a sightseeing jaunt, or hikers who want quicker access to the backcountry. The scene is set for a conflict which is becoming all too common in Alaska. Air Aviation Vice President Brian Blixhaven says the park's big enough to accommodate his company's plans for heli-hiking and heli-rafting tours.
We understand that there should be certain places where there is what they call the natural quiet, and we respect that. However, we think with a size of the park such as the Denali State Park, that there should be room for other activities as well, and that's what we're trying to do is provide a variation or a number of different types of tours.
Both sides agree that helicopters probably disturb less vegetation or scenery than airplanes, but conservationists say they're too noisy. The Alaska Center for the Environment is already suing the Forest Service, and Cliff Eames says his group opposes allowing helicopters in any public land airspace.
I just believe that they are too disruptive for people on the ground, you know, be they recreationists or cabin owners or local residents, that they can be very disruptive to wildlife, and that in many instances for commercial flight seeing and recreational purposes there is an alternative, and that's the fixed-wing airplane, which although it can be intrusive as well, it doesn't create nearly the same problems because of the type of noise it makes that helicopters do.
Aera Aviation's application to secure a permit from the State Division of Parks comes as no surprise to Director Jim Stratton. With next May's scheduled opening of the Princess Lodge on Denali's south side and increased interest in flight seeing nationwide, the opportunity for Aera is obvious. Stratton says the park's master plan always recognized that helicopter landings would be a part of the blend of activities available.
What we wanted to do is to identify places where the helicopters can land, and then to work with Aera and any other applicant down the road to look at travel routes in, elevation, number of flights, you know, those kinds of things to try and, you know, minimize the impact that, you know, helicopters would have on other recreational users in the park, but at the same time allow for that kind of recreational opportunity, the use of helicopters, to occur.
Stratton says the division has identified 5 sites where helicopter landings won't interfere with current uses. Proposed state regulations would limit helicopter landing permits to these 5 sites. Before a permit can be granted, the issue must go before the State Parks Citizens Advisory Committee. Stratton says there might be a point where there are too many helicopters on state lands, but he doesn't know where that is because the number changes depending on who's talking. His job, he says, is to help find the balance. In Fairbanks, I'm Teresa Bacher.
Three, two, one. For 5 days last week, Japanese and American scientists hammered out details on how to harmoniously share data, research, and quarters in a multi-million dollar building. Joining them were government officials from both sides of the Pacific, as well as university administrators. Dr. Sean Akasofu, who directs UAF's Geophysical Institute, is a prime player in discussions. He says after funding agreements between Alaska, Japan, and the U.S. were finalized in January, architects and contractors jumped on the project.
Usually what happens is that we decide what to do first, then what kind of building we need, and then we proceed. But this one is we got to go to the building first, because there's all kinds of requirements that needed for the building.
Now, Akasofu says, scientists and policymakers are scrambling to lay down not only the priorities of office space, but of research projects too. It's a point not lost on National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administrator Larry Enomoto. Enomoto wants scientists to coordinate their work with U.S. agencies like NOAA. Enomoto says in the wake of congressional budget cuts, most American science, however, is heading towards such cooperative ventures.
Just as an example, NOAA now is just having discussions with the Europeans to share our polar mission, where the Europeans would actually put up a satellite. We would put our instruments on their satellite, and we'd be doing this on a cooperative basis. So that's an example of how we are being forced now to share our missions with foreign partners. The International Arctic Research Center would be an attempt, I think, to do the same thing, and hopefully on a very coordinated basis.
UAF's new center is also a good deal for school administrators. By November, the Japanese will have invested $19 million into the project, 60% of total costs. Not only will the school's scientists gain access to new space and laboratories at bargain rates, but the new joint projects have a better chance at funding, boosting the school's revenues and overhead charges. Geophysicist Glenn Shaw says even as U.S. lawmakers contemplate cutting research 20 to 30%, the Japanese are gearing up for a massive new investment.
Japanese have been in a recession for quite a long time, and it's a persistent recession. And one of the things that they have done in their self-critique is conclude that they need to do more science and be more self-starting in the area of science. And so the Diet has approved just recently a major, major increase of some hundreds of billion, $100 billion over the next 10 years in science.
Shaw says if you allow for the difference in population size between the two countries, that would be like the United States pledging something like $1 trillion to science over the next 10 years. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
I would like to see the railroad use some of its recent increased profits and its projected increased profits from Princess Tours and other places to go ahead and hire the extra crew that it takes to have two stops.
For as long as scientists have studied hibernating animals, they've wondered why these animals periodically interrupt their repose. Like clockwork, some mental alarm triggers hibernators to start shivering and stoking their metabolic fires. For the Arctic ground squirrel, it's every 3 weeks or so, says animal physiologist Brian Barnes. Once roused, the squirrel stays warm for less than a day, then sinks back to its torpor for another 3 weeks.
The cost of those arousals, if you measure the energy expended to shiver and shake and warm up like that, is enormous. If you added up the energy expended for each of these dozen or so arousals over the 6 months of winter, they represent 80%, 90% of the energy the animal's expending over the entire winter. Why do they do it?
Barnes garnered international attention several years back when his research showed the Arctic ground squirrel actually supercools its system to below freezing, something no one expected in a creature that large. Now his explanation for why hibernators rouse themselves is also starting to attract attention. Barnes says it seems the squirrel expends all that precious energy just so it can grab some shut-eye.
The suggestion is that with those cold brains, they can't sleep. But sleep is so important, it's such a crucial thing for animals to do, that even in the state of hibernation, they have to do it, and they'll pay dearly for it. What we're suggesting is that they warm up every 2 or 3 weeks through the winter at great cost in order to achieve sleep.
Scientists have known for decades deep sleep is essential for survival. Experiments in the 1980s showed rats died after a month without sleep. Exactly why sleep is so crucial still puzzles scientists, and Barnes doesn't claim to answer that question. But hibernation isn't sleep, and he says when electrodes are hooked up to hibernators in labs around the world, the brainwave patterns, or EEGs, show that.
In each of those labs, including here, measuring EEGs during the hibernation pattern has shown that, indeed, when the animals warm up, they go directly into deep sleep, and they stay in sleep throughout most of the period when their body temperatures are warm.
Barnes's research also shows the longer a hibernating brain is deprived of sleep, the deeper and longer it will nap when it can. While Barnes's sleep theory intrigues Norman Ruby, the Stanford researcher isn't quite convinced. Ruby also studies hibernators, and he recently made scientific headlines by publishing data suggesting he's found the spot in the brain, the mental alarm clock, that rouses hibernators. Ruby points to a Stanford colleague's work which indicates ground squirrels pull themselves from the torpor to burn fat.
They can only burn so much fat when they're very cold, so they warm up to mobilize some more fat and then go back in. And that as they start to run out of fat during a particular bout of torpor, that's a cue to wake up.
Barnes agrees his theory is tentative, but he counters the two notions are compatible. Arctic ground squirrels probably take care of a number of biological tasks when they warm up, including catching up on shut-eye and metabolizing fat. And both Ruby and Barnes agree the mystery of sleep and its importance in life is still shrouded in darkness. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
Recently, five southwestern villages banded together to form the Yupik Indian Housing Authority, and now the Yukon River Village of Nulato is applying for federal recognition. Nulato Tribal Administrator Peter Demoski says the Interior Regional Housing Authority, which represents nearly 50 villages, is too big. IRHA secured funding for one 40-home project in Nulato last decade and just finished another in 1995. Demoski, though, says his neighbors can't wait another 10 years for the next round.
If Nulato had its own Indian Housing Authority, we'd have access to the federal funds that IRHA is receiving, and we could operate a housing weatherization, rehabilitation, or even new construction program, you know, whenever we want.
But Office of Native American Programs Administrator Marlon Knight says it's not that easy. Housing authorities compete for a pool of money. Applications are ranked, and not all get funded. And until Nulato gets a grant to build new homes, the authority won't even have a budget. Knight says staff salaries, travel, commissioner training, and supplies are all paid for by the tenants and homebuyers, and that could be a large burden for them.
It's very difficult for a community of one village to run a housing authority. There's some very basic costs that have to be covered, and those are the kinds of things we want to point out. We don't prohibit, you know, if the tribe can come up with additional funds and show that, you know, they can conduct the business. It's pretty much up to them. We don't try to make that call.
Knight says Nulato would be the only authority to represent the community. The IRHA would no longer be authorized to seek grants for them. Still, that doesn't answer the status of the housing units already operating there. And IRHA Director Joe Wilson says that's something the two organizations would have to work out.
It would not be an automatic turnover of assets. After all, the housing authority has, a contract with HUD to and have put a lot of effort into developing those units and managing those units. So it would be a matter, you know, that it is in a matter that I have not discussed with Nulato or any other party at this point in time.
Demoski says the Nulato Tribal Council will attempt to negotiate with the IRHA for the HUD contracts. He says the council wants to see that money stay in the village. So far, the Nulato Tribal Council has approved an ordinance recognizing the proposed housing authority, its bylaws, and commissioners. Knight says they still need to submit a letter from their attorney saying the paperwork they've filed is legal. And after that, they're on their own. In Fairbanks, I'm Teresa Bacher.
While most states receive the lion's share of their research dollars from industry, Alaska gets 75% from the federal government, and most of that goes to the University of Alaska. Those figures prompted the American Association for the Advancement of Science, or AAAS, to issue a report. It warns federal efforts to balance the budget by cutting roughly 20% out of non-defense research programs will hit the state's university hard. Moreover, says Albert Tyke, who directs AAAS's science and policy programs, the effect of those cuts will ripple through the state's economy.
There's a lot of research funding that comes to this state from the Commerce Department through the National Marine Fisheries Service, part of NOAA, and also through the Department of Energy, having to do with some of the programs both from Native peoples, energy relating to their needs. And both the Department of Energy and Commerce have been targets of efforts to eliminate them.
Tyke is in Alaska for the Association's Arctic Science Conference at Girdwood. He says the AAAS doesn't have a position on when or how to balance the federal budget deficit, but he thinks cutting scientific programs could do grave harm to future American research. UAF Provost Jack Keating acknowledges federal dollars for research are likely to continue shrinking, but he says the school is in a good position to compete for funding.
We are increasingly competitive in the sense, even in the hard times that have been current for last year and the year before, as the federal dollars toward research has dried up, we have been disproportionately successful and actually increased our research money.
Keating also sees more research funding coming from UAF's budding connections with industry. Keating will discuss the AAAS report at its conference today and tomorrow. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon. Three, two, one. It'll be like robbing Peter to pay Paul, says Colonel Glenn Godfrey. While the Alaska State Troopers don't have the money for a new position, the head of the department says Delta will get a third officer. Godfrey says he's been looking at Delta's statistics for some time. In 1995, the two troopers there fielded roughly 1,400 calls, and it looks like they'll take as many this year.
We're severely understaffed. Since the early 80s, we've closed down 30 Alaska State Trooper posts. We're down about 100 trooper positions. So in a nutshell, the Alaska State Troopers are understaffed in all our posts, basically. It just appears that we're more understaffed in Delta than I'd like us to be understaffed at this time.
Given the tight budget, Godfrey is looking to move a position from one of the cities to staff Delta. Godfrey announced the plan last week at a packed town meeting held over concerns about Trooper Rose Edgren, but he says the two actions are not connected. Earlier this year, Edgren shot a man, later convicted of attempted murder. For her action, Edgren earned a state medal for bravery and was profiled on national TV. But more than 60 Delta citizens signed a petition saying Edgren is prejudiced and asked for her transfer. Colonel Godfrey called last Thursday's meeting to hear them out. Steve Du Bois attended, but he wasn't there to complain. Du Bois circulated his own pro-Edgren petition 7 hours before the meeting. He says he got more than 300 signatures.
Yeah, we gave the petition to the troopers at the public meeting on Thursday night. I would estimate that between 120 and 150 people showed up at the meeting. The vast majority of those, I believe, were supporting Trooper Edgren and were trying to express their opinion that she's been doing what the community feels is a good job, and they did not support having her transferred.
Du Bois thinks Colonel Godfrey got the message, but Leonard Thomas didn't find satisfaction last Thursday. He'd like to see Trooper Edgren transferred. He thinks because she was born and raised in Delta, she's too close to some issues.
Whether that's really a good idea to, say, train a trooper, put them in their hometown, keep them there all their life, and retire them there. And whether maybe it wouldn't be a better policy to rotate and maybe not assign hometown people to their trooper posts.
Thomas says troopers made it clear they don't transfer based on petition, but they outlined how to make a formal complaint. So for now, Edgren stays in Delta. And if management's plans work out, she and her colleague will soon be joined by a third trooper. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
I think probably more of these materials that are in the book sale have come from donations that we either already have and don't need a second copy and don't have room for second copies anyway, or which are in bad condition, they're marked up, they're falling apart, or which are not appropriate for the collection.
Bibliophiles turn into animals at the prospect of cheap books. It's much like a Macy's basement sale. People really have an intense interest in books, and they want the right book, and this is their chance, and it's pretty much a free-for-all.
The B-17 went down near Ruby more than 40 years ago. Late this summer, an aircraft salvage crew recovered parts of the wreck to help reconstruct another B-17. It also retrieved most, but not all, of the plane's 50 caliber machine gun rounds. Ruby's school principal, Keith Burnson, says two junior high students ended up with some of the plane's ammunition.
Took the opportunity to do a little exploring. Nothing wrong with that. That's a very normal young person's activity, and they found some treasures. I have no knowledge or reason to believe they knew they were dangerous. They're brightly colored, they're bullets, and that attracts a young fellow's eye. And I don't think anyone's blaming them for picking them up.
Burnson says parents are worried about the stability of the old ammunition and has reported the problem to the state troopers. A trooper in Galena says the shells are dangerous, with a casing of about 6.5 inches long filled with gunpowder. An Air Force spokesman in Fairbanks says the shells shouldn't be any more unstable than new ammunition, but should still be treated with care. Burnson admits while the community is trying to get the kids to turn in the ammo, it's hard to convince a youngster to part with a valued find. Reports indicate the B-17 crashed in 1943 on its way to Nome as part of the war effort against the Japanese. The pilot and co-pilot only had about 10 total hours of experience on the plane, and when one of the engines caught fire, they couldn't put it out. The pilots bailed out of the plane, and it crashed near Ruby. In Galena, I'm Scott Campbell.
The State Board of Education would like to hand out money to school districts in a manner which better takes into account their access to local revenue. For the Valdez school system, which enjoys one of the state's healthiest budgets, that means trouble. During their last meeting, Valdez Superintendent Harry Rogers told the school board the state's proposed formula could cost Valdez City Schools $3 million, or a third of their budget, over the next 3 years. In response, the Valdez school board has approved a resolution to the Association of Alaska School Boards opposing any reformulation that doesn't increase overall funding. Valdez school board president Marilyn Leahy.
The association has been suggesting a change in the foundation formula for some time, with the proviso that we may be able to make a more fair distribution, but we need to put more money into the formula itself to make it pass the legislature, and also because there simply isn't enough money coming to the districts from the state, is our position.
The board's resolution makes light of the proposed formula's targeting of richer districts like the North Slope, Unalaska, and Valdez, from which to redistribute funding to those in cities with lesser tax bases. No one opposes increasing funding for poorer districts, but Leahy says Valdez is in a squeeze of its own.
We have a lot of property that is worth a lot of money, more so than other districts, but the thing to remember about Valdez is that we're not like the other two districts. Unlike any other community in the state, or even any other in the nation that I know about, our value is decreasing every year. So what we're worth continues to decrease, and that has a direct effect on how much we can generate locally.
Leahy says the local decline is attributed to the depreciation of the pipeline terminal. The Valdez School Board's resolution goes to the Alaska Association of School Boards for consideration at their annual meeting in November. The association provides a statewide consensus of what school boards are thinking. Any real change to the state's education funding formula must go through the legislature. In Valdez, I'm Dan Bross.